In our last session, I introduced the topic of post-colonialism, and we discussed two important thinkers from this domain, you could say. They were Aimé Césaire and Frantz Fanon. Both of them were post-World War II authors. They were the first authors of the decolonized era, you could say. And they also had something else in common. They were both rooted in the French-speaking colonial world. Today, we're going to look at two different authors. They come from the same time. They're both born in the 1930s, so they become active in the 1950s and 60s. But these two have very different roots. The first one, Toni Morrison, is an Afro-American novelist, literary editor, and critic. The second, Edward Said, is a Palestinian-American literary scholar. Now, for authors such as Césaire and Fanon, who grew up in the periphery of French culture, the most urgent question was the creation, or rediscovery, of an African culture. But was that African culture equally absent or invisible in existing Western culture? The situation of Afro-Americans in the United States showed a different picture of post-colonialism, and this was due to historical circumstances. Africans and Afro-Americans had been part of American society for four centuries, and therefore also their culture. Such an Africanism, if you may call it that way, however, was present but not always visible in American culture. Where was it to be found in literature, for example? Novelist Toni Morrison addressed these questions. She was born in Ohio in 1931 and came from an Afro-American middle-class family. Her father was working in the steel industry. During her youth, Morrison witnessed how profoundly racism was embedded in American society. When she was just 2 years old, the proprietor of her family's home set the house on fire because her parents were unable to keep up with the rent. Morrison studied at the historically black Howard University in Washington. In that city, she first experienced the segregation of black and white people. In the 1950s, Washington still had racially separated buses and restaurants. After her studies, Morrison worked as an English teacher at various American universities, and she worked as an editor for literary publishers. She drew attention to the work of new black authors, such as Wole Soyinka and Ethel Fugard. She also published the autobiography of the world-famous boxer Muhammad Ali. As an author of fiction, Morrison had her national breakthrough during the 1970s. Her most famous book, however, only came at the end of the 1980s, and that was Beloved. Beloved tells the story of a black woman who manages to escape slavery, but is tracked down by slave hunters. Terrified of being caught, she kills her young daughter out of despair. The moment she also wants to take her own life, she is captured. The novel tells how the spirit of the young daughter continues to haunt the mother and her family. The book received the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. In 1993, Morrison was the first black woman to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. She also received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama in 2012. And last year, she died in New York. In 1992, Morrison published a remarkable book, Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and Literary Imagination. It was her first essay about the history of literature. Let me go deeper into that, so that we have an eye on her philosophy of art, more particularly her philosophy of literature. And her philosophy of literature is strongly based on the concept of empathy, or the writer's ability of entering what one is estranged from. That's a quote from her work. That means the ability to empathize even with people or creatures that are very different from yourself. Let me give you a longer quote from her work. In my capacity as a writer, I have to place enormous trust in my ability to imagine others and my willingness to project consciously into the danger zones such others may represent for me. I am drawn to the ways all writers do this. I am interested in what prompts and makes possible this process of entering what one is estranged from, and in what disables the foray, for purposes of fiction, into corners of the consciousness held off and away from the reach of the writer's imagination. My work requires me to think about how free I can be as an African-American woman writer in my genderized, sexualized, wholly racialized world. Imagining is not merely looking or looking at, nor is it taking oneself intact into the other. It is, for the purposes of the work, becoming. End of quote. Let me now zoom in on her views of the history of American literature. The starting point of the book is a traditional assumption that American literature has not been fundamentally influenced by the 400-year-old presence of Africans and Afro-Americans in the United States. In fact, the established view of American literature holds that what is seen as the essentially American character of that literature would be completely unrelated to racial issues. To this view, Morrison opposes that the theme of blackness has exerted a decisive influence on the American literary imagination, so she disagrees with that traditional assumption sketched just a few moments ago. More importantly, prominent authors such as Edgar Allan Poe, Mark Twain, or Ernest Hemingway could only define the essence of Americanism by contrasting it with the black presence. I quote, "The contemplation of this black presence is central to any understanding of our national literature and should not be permitted to hover at the margins of the literary imagination." The fact now that literary critics never recognized this fact does not change much, according to her. Morrison examines different reasons for this silence. I will not go over all of them, but one of them stands out, I think, because it reminds us of the investigations of Frantz Fanon into the psychology of the colonizer, and not only the psychology of the colonized. This is something that is lacking in our thinking about colonialism, Morrison states. It is mostly being done from the perspective of the victim and not of the perpetrator. Let me again quote from her book. "Another reason for this quite ornamental vacuum in literary discourse on the presence and influence of Africanist people in American criticism is the pattern of thinking about racialism in terms of its consequences on the victim, of always defining it asymmetrically from the perspective of its impact on the object of racist policy and attitudes. But that well-established study should be joined with another equally important one: the impact of racism on those who perpetuate it. It seems both poignant and striking how avoided and unanalyzed is the effect of racist inflection on the subject. What I propose here is to examine the impact of notions of racial hierarchy, racial exclusion, and racial vulnerability and availability on non-blacks who held, resisted, explored, or altered these notions." End of quote. Morrison concludes that it would certainly be false to state that American literature would be raceless. On the contrary, I quote, "The act of enforcing racelessness in literary discourse is itself a racial act." End of quote. And there's another quote I want to give you. "A criticism that needs to insist that literature is not only universal, but also race-free, risks lobotomizing that literature and diminishes both the art and the artist." End of quote. Morrison explains in her book how black slavery was an essential part of the country's creative soil. The African slave and his later offspring in the ghetto formed a canvas for the projection of American fears about unfreedom. It was a playground for the imagination. Precisely the typically American ideal of freedom could only be so sharply marked against the dark background of the slave's lack of freedom. I quote, "What rose up out of collective needs to allay internal fears and to rationalize external exploitation was an American Africanism, a fabricated brew of darkness, otherness, alarm, and desire that is uniquely American." End of quote. When she became aware of this, Morrison writes, it was as if she had been looking at the contents of a fishbowl all the time, the gliding of the golden scales of the fish, the movement of the gills, the plastic castle at the bottom, and now she suddenly saw the glass bowl itself. Africanism, she posits, is like the fishbowl, a transparent and invisible structure that permits the ordered life to exist within. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about the thinking of Toni Morrison. Now let's turn to a very different thinker, and his name is Edward Said. Edward Said is a Palestinian-American literary scholar. He was born in 1935 in what was then called the British Mandate of Palestine. And actually, there's an interesting parallel between Toni Morrison and Edward Said. Toni Morrison thinks about the present, but largely invisible presence of African-Americans in American literature, just as Edward Said is thinking about the presence of Orientals, Oriental topics, Oriental characters in European literature and European art in the 19th century. And he sees something similar. He sees that although Orientalism, as he calls it, is very much visible in European culture of the 19th and the 20th century, it's also strongly dependent on stereotypes. It is the presence of Orientals in this literature and in this art and in this European culture of the 19th and 20th century serves to reinforce stereotypes of the West about the East and about themselves. Let me try to argue that in a little more detail. First, let me tell you something more about the person Edward Said and his background. I think that's useful in order to understand his ideas better. Said was born in 1935, as I said, in what was then called the British Mandate of Palestine, now today the State of Israel. His father, Wadi Said, was a Palestinian who had fought alongside the Americans during the First World War. He had been rewarded for that service with the American nationality. After the war, he had built a successful career as a businessman in Cairo, in Egypt, and Jerusalem. The wealth of the Said family made it possible for both Edward and his sister Rosemary to visit the expensive European schools of the Middle East. After that, they both did higher studies at American universities. Said had quite ambiguous memories, however, of his school days at St. George School in Jerusalem and Victoria College in Alexandria in Egypt. On the one hand, his schooling had made him well acquainted with the European Canaan. He also met classmates from Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. They were being prepared to become the future elite, the future politicians and businessmen of their respective countries. One of Said's classmates, for instance, was the later King Hussein of Jordan. On the other hand, the school regime was strictly British. The first rule at Victoria College in Egypt was that only English should be spoken, although that was not the native language of any of the pupils. Hence, the boys grew up under a thoroughly colonial regime, which from the beginning installed the inherent superiority of the Western language and its culture. When he later looked back on his school period, Said said it had given him a hybrid identity. He was, and I quote, a Palestinian going to school in Egypt with an English first name, an American passport, and no certain identity at all. To make matters worse, Arabic, my native language, and English, my school language, were inextricably mixed. I have never known which was my first language, and I have felt fully at home in neither, although I dream in both. Every time I speak an English sentence, I find myself echoing it in Arabic, and vice versa. End of quote. After he went to the United States, Said studied at the universities of Princeton and Harvard. At Harvard, he also obtained his doctorate in English literature in 1964. His first book, based on his doctoral research, discussed the work of the Polish-English novelist Joseph Conrad. One of Conrad's most well-known works is the novel Heart of Darkness, which appeared in 1899. It is possibly the most famous colonial novel ever written, also due to the book, to it having served as the inspiration for the movie Apocalypse Now by Francis Ford Coppola. Conrad situated the story of the possessed ivory dealer Kurtz against the background of the colonial rubber trade and the exploitation of the native population in the Congo Free State. In 1963, Said began teaching English and comparative literature at Columbia University in New York. He would continue to do so over the next 40 years of his life, and his research focused on what he called Orientalism. It was also the title of his most famous book, which appeared in 1978. Orientalism is a collective term for the exotic clichés that Eastern characters, themes, and decors traditionally receive in Western culture. Typical examples of Orientalism include the lascivious harem scenes in the Orientalist paintings of the 19th century or the stereotypes of Easterners or Arabs among ethnographers and historians. As I have discussed previously, exotic elements were present in almost every aspect of European culture around 1900, in the architecture, on the theater stage, in the literature, in painting. According to Said, their significance is much larger than just a fashionable style of decoration. Orientalism is based on stereotypical ideas about the East, which in turn are the result of the colonial mismatch. That the ordinary Westerner sees the Orient as sultry, luxurious, magical, and anti-scientific is an idea that was constructed on the basis of the actual state of political domination. I will go into the topic of Orientalism later on in this podcast in a few moments, but let me first give you some more background about Said's career. During his career, Said gave numerous lectures at universities in America and abroad. In addition to his academic activities, he was also a noted political figure. In the aftermath of the Six-Day War in 1967 between Israel and the Arab countries, Said tried to sensitize Western public opinion to the position of Palestine and the other Arab countries. In 1977, he even became an independent member of the National Council of Palestine. In this capacity, he was a close witness of the diplomatic developments in the Arab-Israeli conflict. All his life, he advocated a two-state solution, which would create a legitimate Palestinian state alongside the Israeli state. That is why he could not accept the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993, which preempted the establishment of such a Palestinian state. In other areas too, Said committed himself to a sustainable and peaceful solution to the conflict between Israel and the Arab countries. Together with the Jewish musician Daniel Barenbaum, he founded the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in 1999. It's a youth orchestra. It still exists today. It's based in Seville, in Spain. It unites Jewish, Israeli, Palestinian, and Arab musicians. In 2003, Edward Said died of leukemia. Now, let me go deeper into the topic of Orientalism. What is the basis, Said asks, for the cultural clichés with which the West looks at the East? That's a question he tries to answer in his most famous book, Orientalism. The Orient, Said says, is much more than a geographical concept. For the West, it has always been a canvas on which all kinds of fantasies, desires, and fears were projected. It is not a neutral indication of a certain region or of certain peoples or cultures, but it's an artificial cultural construction. Just like the West itself, the East is an idea with a separate history, a tradition, a visual language, and a vocabulary. The stereotypes developed by Orientalist thinking enabled Western nations to launch a long series of military invasions, and the Orient is thus one of the most persistent images of the other in the West. Now, traces of Orientalism are already to be found in Greek antiquity and during the European Renaissance. You could say Western culture has always had cultural clichés and stereotypes and prejudices about the people in the East. But Orientalism has especially gained momentum since colonialism and more particularly since the conquest of Egypt by Napoleon in 1798. European scholars from then on began to call themselves Orientalists when they specialized in the languages, the history, the religion, or the culture of the countries of the Middle East. There were scientific societies such as the Société Asiatique or the Royal Asiatic Society. And that was not a neutral scientific enterprise, Said argues. It was part of a coherent colonial system. Just as the cultural treasures of Egypt and Iraq could end up in Western museums thanks to Western political domination in those countries, intellectual Orientalism was also a product of colonization. A typical example of this interaction between cultural and political domination is the Description de l'Égypte, or Description of Egypt, a monumental scientific work that appeared in 23 volumes between 1809 and 1828. It was the main achievement of the Institut d'Égypte, or Egyptian Institute, a scientific institute founded by Napoleon to document and archive his conquest of the country. The Orientalists of the Institute were entirely part of the occupying power. They were given the task of academically digesting and processing the culture and history of the country. It was a scientific enterprise, Said says, that would lay the foundation for 19th century Orientalism. And I quote, "The Orient was reconstructed, reassembled, crafted, in short, born out of the Orientalists' efforts. The description became master type of all further efforts to bring the Orient closer to Europe, thereafter to absorb it entirely and centrally important, to cancel or at least subdue and reduce its strangeness and, in the case of Islam, its hostility." End of quote. The Western scholars started from the idea that only they could understand the complex history of the Orientals. That was simply the consequence of the inherent inferiority of the Arabian race, they believed. British colonials, such as Lord Cromer, the Consul General of Egypt, described Arabs as essentially irrational, prone to lying, illogical, devoid of energy and initiative, and lethargic. According to Said, it is not surprising or problematic in itself that the West creates an image of the Oriental for itself. It is self-evident and natural that people categorize the world around them. The problem is rather that the image created of the Orient by the Orientalists is always a biased image. It is a stereotype that has a specific role to play, namely to valorize the cultural superiority of the West on a cultural level. In fact, it is a staging which is does not necessarily agree with reality. And this is how Said himself describes that phenomenon. I quote, and this is my the quote with which I want to conclude this podcast. "Underlying all the different units of Orientalist discourse, by which I mean simply the discourse employed whenever the Orient is spoken or written about, is a set of representative figures or tropes. These figures are to the actual Orient as stylized costumes are to the characters in a play. They are like, for example, the cross that every man will carry, or the party-colored costume worn by a harlequin in the Commedia dell'arte play. In other words, we need not look for correspondence between the language used to depict the Orient and the Orient itself, not so much because the language is inaccurate, but because it is not even trying to be accurate. What it is trying to do is at one and the same time to characterize the Orient as alien and to incorporate it schematically on a theatrical stage whose audience, manager, and actors are for Europe, and only for Europe." End of quote. Thank you for listening to this podcast.